New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Hello and welcome. I'm Emmy Vadnais, co-host with Jeffrey Mishlove. Today, we'll be exploring ancient magic rituals with my guest, Dr. Irving Finkel, who is Senior Assistant Keeper of Ancient Mesopotamian Script, Languages and Cultures at the British Museum. He is the curator in charge of cuneiform inscriptions on tablets of clay from ancient Mesopotamia, of which the Middle East Department has the largest collection of any modern museum. He is author of several books, including The First Ghosts, The Ark Before Noah, The Lewis Chessmen and What Happened to Them, and The Last Resort Library. If you enjoy this program, please like, subscribe, press the bell icon, and share. Dr. Irving is located in London, England. Now I'll switch over to the internet video. Welcome, Dr. Irving Finkel. It is a great joy to have you back with me on New Thinking Aloud today.
Lovely. I'm glad to be here.
The last time we spoke, we discussed your fabulous book, The First Ghosts. And in that book, you share, and also from your doctoral dissertation, you talk about these ancient magic rituals. And in your book, it seemed that there was a lot about getting rid of ghosts, but also sometimes conjuring up ghosts. And at the same time, in ancient Mesopotamia, there seems to be a whole history of many magic rituals.
Yes, that's true. That's correct. In fact, the work of the exorcist, who was responsible for getting rid of things that you don't want, was quite extensive, far beyond just dealing with ghosts, but all sorts of other things as well. And in fact, in Mesopotamia, in ancient Mesopotamia, the resources which survive, the ancient documents which survive, show us quite a lot about the whole range of things which a professional had to deal with using what you might call magic or ritual. See, these are very heavy and loaded terms. Ritual, for example, is a sort of abstract which people discuss in terms of this society and that society, ancient and modern. It's a phenomenon. And ritual itself is not quite the same as rituals, which are specific activities, often very traditional, handed down, hallowed, in fact, by use, which attempt to use forces in the world, in the universe, which surround mankind for either good purposes or for evil purposes. So the general consensus was that it was possible to harness forces in order to change what might otherwise happen. So it wasn't that everybody did this all the time or it was a daily activity, but it was something which the people who were specialists, they were well trained in writing, they'd studied all sorts of esoteric documents and straightforward healing rituals and other kinds of rituals, so that they knew when there was a problem to be dealt with, that there was usually a whole bundle of special texts, special activities that had come down from before, which they knew would be very helpful in a particular context, or sometimes they'd be successful in a context. They didn't always guarantee it. So this picture is perhaps most easy to understand by the fact that in ancient Assyria, in about the 8th century BC, in one of the libraries of the kings of Assyria, somebody wrote a tablet which had on it all the responsibilities of the exorcist at large. So somebody who was referred to as an exorcist, who knew the value of ritual and magic, had a large range of specialities. So some of them, as you say, worked with ghosts, how to drive them away, how to mollify them, how to send them back to the netherworld, and once in a while, how to bring them up to the world where we live in order to ask them questions about the future, which was a rather risky thing. But the interface with the ghost issue, although quite big and quite important because it affected a lot of people, was not by any means the only thing. But the word exorcism, which exists in the modern world and it's known to people who study things in a much later period, the Catholic Church, in fact, even has on its staff people who can do an exorcism if they believe that one of the parishioners has been invaded by a force from outside and it needs to be driven out. They still even have these rituals alive in the modern Catholic Church. And in many religions of the world, there are rituals, big and small, which still function and are still revered. But in Mesopotamia, the exorcist, and we're talking about the period from perhaps about 2500 BC until about the first century AD, that sort of span, where we have a lot of literature, a lot of tablets with writing on, and many of them are to do with this exorcist and what they had to do. So the basic force that they operated in alliance with was benevolent. That is to say, they knew magic words, magic activities, which would nullify the forces of evil, drive out demons or ghosts in possession, deal with witches and wizards, all those things. They offered defense and sometimes proactive attack of the forces to which normal people felt themselves vulnerable. So, for example, in the villages of Mesopotamia, not everybody lived in the big cities with large buildings and rich and famous persons, but there were farmers and people who lived in the outskirts and in the villages up and down the country, and they manned the rivers and they went fishing and they had boats, all those sort of population. They didn't know much about all the stuff that we know on tablets because it had nothing to do with them. They were actually living real life, having babies and getting on with things. But in a village context, for example, in Mesopotamia, say in 1000 BC, there might be a small number of people and there might be one old lady in the village that everybody would know was somebody to be careful of, because some old ladies are very good at everything. They know how to get splinters out of things or things out of your eye, or if someone's having trouble with giving birth, they know how to deal with that. They're kind of a resource for traditional family healing things. There must have been lots of people like that. And some of them were not quite the same or quite so benevolent. They were kind of mean and nasty, and they whispered about people and they poked fingers at people. And it was widely believed that the malice of witches and wizards, for example, which might be loose in society, could really harm people. It could really affect them, it make them ill, make them suffer badly. And the explanation for it is in a way, I think, like this, because before you have modern medicine, when people became ill or suffered misfortune or any of the disadvantaged things about life, when that happened, sometimes they knew that there was a reason. So, for example, if they put their hand in a candle flame, they knew that they would burn themselves, and they knew if they were naughty and pinched something, it might catch up with them. But very often things happen to people, bad things happen, for no apparent reason. And they had in Mesopotamia a rather nice system that everybody had one of the gods looking after them. There were hundreds and hundreds of gods, and you had one who looked after you. You were supposed to keep an eye on you. But gods, like people, didn't concentrate. They weren't very responsible, and sometimes they went on holiday, and sometimes they forgot all about their poor human beings. So you might be vulnerable. And one of the things you could be vulnerable to is other humans' malice. So witchcraft and sorcery, say in the second millennium BC, was a common subject of fear. And it's not only old ladies, it's also unmarried women or women with long hair and staring eyes who looked a bit strange and did knitting on the underground or anything like that. Those sorts of persons, when you had a problem, you think, it's them, because you had no other explanation. And there are two features that bear on this issue, because in the modern world, it always seems to a person When they hear that someone's got cancer and is going to die, it's the wrong person because they're a wonderful person and you don't want them to die, and it's not fair at all. And you could think of loads of other people who do much better off getting cancer and going to the next world immediately. And that's a sort of basic human idea. It's partly why me and partly what have I done? And none of these questions can be answered. So at some point in the history of ideas, sorcery and witchcraft is a very convenient explanation for unexplained mishaps. So your exorcist, your professional person, knew how to deal with this. So sometimes it was quite a simple matter of wearing some kind of wool with some kind of stone on, which would have a magic effect. Another thing might be that you start a ritual where you make in wax an image of the person you consider to be the witch, and you dress them up in a little dress, and perhaps you write their name on their back. Then you get a needle and run it through, and somewhere 50 miles away, the witch in question is supposed to die in agony. And that sort of magical idea, which is a simple principle, but there are many complicated versions of it, sometimes going over several days, is this thing one can easily understand. It's called sympathetic magic, and it applies in many societies of the world in different kinds of ways. But in Mesopotamia, it was the best way to deal with witches and male sorcerers who weren't quite as feared as the women, but they were certainly around. So your exorcist, who when he went to work in the morning and had to think, what's going to happen to me today? An example of witchcraft might be a common one. And another thing might be someone who is really ill. They have a fever, they have stomach ache, they have diarrhea, they have this, that, and the other. And the exorcist who was in charge of magic would have a colleague called the asu, who is more like we call the doctor. And he would know about things that you could drink, you could take as a potion, things you apply inside and outside, and special drugs in a mixture, and things that the exorcist would recite as a magic spell to enhance the magic. And they had a whole battery of knowledge where the therapeutic principle and the magical principle ran in harmony together. So whether the same person was in charge of both, or whether the doctor, so to speak, took his colleague with who would do the magic bit, or whether some people did it all, we don't know. But by the time of the big kings of Assyria, they had a library of hundreds of tablets, all arranged from head to foot, with the healing recipes for all the ills of the body, starting at the cranium and going down to the feet. And they collected them together over many, many, many decades, sometimes centuries, in order to get the best of stuff all together in a reference work like an encyclopedia. So in the British Museum recently, a lot of work has been done to reconstruct this encyclopedia. So we have a whole load of tablets on a shelf, this way, this way, and this way. And if you've got something wrong with your lungs, you're coughing a lot, you go to this tablet here and take it out, and it would give you recipes. Some of them, the administration of drugs, some of them, the administration of spells. So your magician, your exorcist, who was the transmitter of ritual activities, would work in conjunction, not in opposition, in order to try and make the patient better, to provide some kind of healing. So as well as prescribing amulets, your exorcist would have to sometimes see that this is the hand of such and such a demon. I recognize this kind of behavior, because his tablets would tell you that if a patient has this thing wrong, and that thing wrong, it's the hand of some evil force, like a particular demon, a particular goddess who was angry or something like that. And then the goddess had to be mollified, or the demon had to be driven away, so that the patient would be clear and free. So they'd have bedside things and more complicated things. And for very serious matters, for example, if a princess in the court was very unwell, everybody would be going up the wall with nerves, and no one would know what to do. And the exorcist would come, and as I imagine it, what the exorcists who worked for the king knew all about the royal family and knew what a fluff they get into. Nothing to worry about here. I'll just deal. Oh, I know what's wrong with you, young lady. Okay, let's have a look. They would do something like that. That might be one approach. Or they might go in there, looking like Rasputin, smelling of evil things and drugs, with a rope around their middle and things hanging around their necks, and look very frightening, but be possessed of magic knowledge that would make the patient better. And I think that one of the things which doctors sometimes forget in the modern world, but of course all real doctors know, is that the way you deal with your patients is more effective than the medicines that you give them very often. This is the most important part of healing, so that your patient feels comfortable in your hands, they relax, they trust you, and when you say, I think you'll be better by next Wednesday, you get better by next Wednesday. Well, there's probably something like that in the whole history of healing. And so the exorcists, we have their texts, we have their magic texts, and it says you recite this three times, you recite that three times. And when you read it, it's a bit sterile. But if you imagine sick person who brings his doctor to the bedside, and you know they're very frightened and their husband's very frightened, and the doctor sits down calmly and pronounces it, I think probably a lot of what they did was beneficial, because they had a very sketchy understanding in antiquity of what makes people ill. They can't have had any alternative, but most of the things which they thought made you ill were invisible. So if you had a demon or a ghost in you, you didn't usually see it. And that was their analysis, that there was something inside the body which made you ill, which had to be removed. Well, you can say, of course, this is very primitive, very early man, very simple. But actually, it's nothing of the kind, because it's exactly the same in terms of patients as the doctor saying, well, you've got a virus, you've got something in your bloodstream, you've got microbes, you've got something inside you. No one's ever seen a microbe. So it's the same kind of principle. The doctor says you've got a microbe and we're going to have to get rid of it. You trust the doctor and out it comes. So by working backwards, it seems to me very probable that the doctors, and we have their texts sometimes over 2,000 years of time, they weren't bluffing their patients, they weren't deluding them or just trying to screw money out of them, but with their experience, they only, most of the things they saw they had seen before, and most of the things they gave them didn't do any harm, and probably sometimes were very beneficial, because it's been shown that some drugs which the Babylonians used and the Egyptians used, just used even today. They've kind of gone down through Greek medicine and Arabic medicine into the Middle Ages, and the same kind of idea that drugs found locally and should be shown to be helpful, of course, are always going to be helpful. So I kind of view these things. I try to view the ancient writings and the ancient practices of this exorcist, for example, with a sort of sympathy, not a criticism that they were primitive or silly, or they didn't know what they were doing, or they were telling lies, but that in their way, they were jolly effective people healing the sick and making them better as far as they could. Now, the thing is that you asked me at the beginning about all these rituals. That's not the only thing that these professionals had to do. There were lots of other things. Babies screamed and wouldn't go to sleep, and you have to have magic and spells and amulets to make the baby shut up. And sometimes women couldn't get pregnant, they needed help with that. And sometimes somebody opened a bar and they wanted the exorcist to come and do magic so that everyone would come and be there and drink together, and the sailors would come when they landed, and it would be a successful business, and a whole slew of other activities. But they're all the professional ones are against evil, against misfortune, or to promote goodness. Now, we know that in this ancient culture of the Sumerians, and especially the Babylonians and Assyrians, in the world of human activity and interface, there was certainly evil magic, because we not only know about the witches who practiced their things and whispered and wrote little spells and stuff like that, but there must have been many other people who tried to harness the forces of evil in the same way that the, what we used to call white magicians, because the use of people say white magic and black magic, or good magic and evil magic, but the people who practiced evil magic undoubtedly used the same sort of ideas as the good magic, but they turn them upside down. And so one of the things that they had to fight against was the people patterning themselves on their own ideas. Now, the benefit of being an exorcist or a magician who dealt on the good side was that all the gods would be on your side. And there are one or two naughty gods, unpleasant ones. They lived mostly down there instead of up there. There were some naughty gods, but not very many of them. But there were loads and loads of gods who all agreed about the difference between good and evil and who would lend their name to things. So when you wrote an amulet, you might say in the name of, and then you'd write the names of 12 or 15 hot gods, so that the evil spirits, which you can't see, and ghostly type things, which you probably wouldn't see, and evil magicians would all be intimidated, knowing that you had the bigger guns on your side. So it was a bit like that, really. And some of the rituals are to do with esoteric activities to promote, like, the success of the king and the well-being of the country at large. And in this catalogue of things which they were responsible for, there are some things we don't know what they are, because they talk about the great water under the earth, and there's some cycle of spells to do with that, and various other things where we've never found the texts that explain what they are. But we have a good handle. It was a busy job. I mean, I don't think they had a consulting clinic in Harley Street, but they would know in a town where the people who did this kind of work lived, and you would go and consult with them. You'd tell them what the problem was, and then they would come and help you. Sometimes they said that the best way to deal with this is to have a seal worn round the neck. And they had a tradition in Mesopotamia that different stones, geologically defined stones, different colour, different texture, different flecks and things like that, had their respective important value, most of it very benevolent. And so they might say, oh, this is a case where I think we need a carnelian seal. Now, a carnelian seal would be rather costly, because carnelian didn't, as it were, grow in ancient Iraq. It had to be brought to the country from perhaps Afghanistan or somewhere like that, somewhere beyond the borders. So if it was really necessary to have a carnelian seal, that's going to run into rather a lot of silver. So I suppose the doctors who prescribed this thing would only do it when they knew that the clients in question, perhaps a fat merchant with a lot of money, would be in a position to pay up without arguing, and they wouldn't impose it on somebody with 9 children and a skinny wife who was dying of lung disease. They wouldn't bring it up. But I think on the whole, I read once there was a very good book written by a man called Guido Mino, and he was professor of medicine in Yale, I think, a really big shot American hospital doctor, head of this, head of that. And he wrote a book in his latter years called The Healing Hand. And what he did was he wrote about the medicine of China and Japan, Egypt and Mesopotamia, Greek and Rome, about the rituals and the activities that the healers did. And he did it in a very sensible way. So he read up about it, all of these different things, because he didn't know them all. And then when he'd done, for example, the Mesopotamian draft chapter, he went to Chicago and met Miguel Seville, who was the best seriologist ever in America, who sat down with him and read through the chapter and pointed to this and pointed to that and explained things. And then he went to Paris, where there was a man called Labatt who knew all about other things to do with medicine. So he wrote a series of chapters in an extremely lively and readable fashion about these medical systems, bringing out to some extent what they had in common and how they differed from culture to culture. And the book is a marvelous introduction to this whole thing of medicine before the modern world. It's very sympathetic, and what's in it is reliable because of this consultation. It's a great pity more people don't write books like that, because very often professional writers who get a commission from a publisher have to write a book which is something like a textbook or a serious book for the public library about something where they don't know anything more than anybody else, and they read Wikipedia and then they look up a few things and then they retype things out of other people's books, and half the stuff which is produced like that is completely worthless. Whereas this is a really inspiring and useful book, and anybody who's remotely interested in how things worked medically before the great progress of the Greeks and then what came afterwards is a very good introductory read. So in the BM, you know, we have all these tablets from ancient Iraq. There are about 130,000 of them, and then about another 50,000 little bits, which we try to join on bit by bit. And they are an extraordinary thing because the fabric that they present, like a kind of wall hanging, covers all aspects of writing in that culture that there were, and they are to a large extent mirrored in our own culture. The purposes for which we use writing, which is at least in the good old days before the world became insane, you had a piece of paper, you had a pencil, you had a typewriter. Things that you recorded by those means are more or less the same. So you have legal and administration matter. You have things to do with the army and the state and the crown. You have things to do with religion, things to do with literature, letters, all those sorts of genre, which if you made a list of 20 things that human beings primarily use writing for, say now or in the Middle Ages or whenever writing was well established, so it was with them. So it means that by some completely unexpected principle, most of the things that were ever written still survive in the ground and then when they're excavated in museums and what have you, because the clay they wrote on, which was impressed with this cuneiform writing, is more or less indestructible. If it's buried because of a warfare and the collapse of houses or there's a fire, it doesn't matter, because when they're excavated, the clay is there and the writing is there. So the most amazing stuff comes out. And we don't have enough people to do all the work even now to read all these documents. And Lord knows what will happen, because one day the world will be like this, that there will be no more warfare because the idiots who are responsible for it will all be dead. And then we won't have any more warfare and we won't have any more struggles of that kind. And everybody will respect everybody else. And then what we will do, we'll all go to Iraq and we'll dig up all these sites, which are there, hundreds and hundreds of them, and find all the tablets. And then we can all sit around reading them and say, hey, look at this. And you read something out and say, well, look, maybe just take a look at this thing. And it would be the most exciting thing. And that has to be done, because it's easy to think this stuff is so old, the languages are dead, it's all pointless, you know, do we really need people to be doing this? But actually, it's to do with the humanities in the biggest possible way. And when you see people naked as they are there, because they didn't manipulate their records, they just had things they wrote down. So you see them more or less without clothes on. You can't see everything, but you get a good angle on the reality of their life, and it evokes sympathy because they are practically speaking the same as we are. And even though it looks very different and their language is dead, and they had their own religion, their own food and their own clothes, and no doubt if three or four Babylonians were on the station platform at King's Cross, everybody would look at them askance and wonder who they were. But if they fell into conversation with them, that would be a whole different matter. Because all humans face the same great dilemmas, the great difficulties, and they have their own ways of dealing with them. But on the whole, they are very similar and comparable. So I think that studying things like ritual, which you might think, well, you know, it's a stuffy old silly thing before proper religion and they didn't know what they were doing and they didn't have any science and it's just the early flutter of semi-imagination. It's nothing of the kind. It is a highly sophisticated, established system where the practitioners worked in accordance with an understanding of very remote tradition. Sometimes they knew that the spells they had were already 1,000 years old and that they respected them, because if someone's been uttering something for 1,000 years, chances are it's rather smart. And they worked on the whole in a beneficial way. Now, there's other sides of this, which we talked about briefly at the beginning, that aside from the magic of incantations and the healing activity, they were very adept at fortune telling, at predicting the future, and they were very adept at astronomy and astrology, which is a kind of blend of astronomy and fortune telling. So all these things, which still are alive in our world and people have in their local newspaper, your prediction when you were born, what's going to happen to you today, all that kind of thing. It began in Mesopotamia because in about 1400 BC, the astronomers who had spent all of their lives looking at the heavens from the vantage point of southern Iraq, where there was no smog in the sky and no pollution, you could see everything perfectly, they started to make observations and collect things, and they worked out how the movements of the planets can be predicted and how eclipses could be predicted. And they had a very serious grasp of astronomy, a large lump of which ended up being improved and developed by the Greeks who went to Babylon and found out about it. They also invented the zodiac, the 12 house thing where the movements through the heavens are there. And that was the origin of the idea that if you're born in such and such a house and such a day, you're going to become a famous radio producer, or you're going to play bass for Elvis Presley or something marvelous like that. So all these things are written on tablets. And when you see the tablets in a museum, which of course everybody should go and do, when you see them, they all look the same. They're bits of clay with wiggly bits on. But actually the breadth of material and the range of it and the sophistication of the things that they wrote about is astonishing, because they were able mathematicians, very able mathematicians. And we have texts from the schoolroom where poor kids who learned how to write a bit and were going to have to be scribes had to learn about geometry and measurement and all those horrible things. And in the British Museum, there's a big tablet with diagrams of geometrical things on with questions underneath. Horrible questions. You know, the sort of thing like when you're at school, they torment you. You know, if it takes three men to build a wall with three courses of brick a month in February, how long would it take them to build the Eiffel Tower? That kind of stupid question. Well, that's the sort of thing the boys had to do there, because if they were going to become scribes, they might become exorcists and diviners or astronomers, and they would have to be extremely good at writing and reading. They'd have to be very able A1 students to go into those disciplines, because they were intellectually of a very high nature. But people who learned to read and write, who were okay but never going to be geniuses, they were kind of put into writing letters, writing administrative documents, things like that. And sometimes they had to work for architects. Now this is a thing which mustn't be underestimated, because everybody knows in antiquity they had palaces, and palaces are like modern palaces. They're much, much bigger than everybody else's house. They're much better built. They have lots of rooms, and they have courtyards, and they have cellars, and they have storage rooms, and they're easy to defend and all that. So any normal king wants a red hot palace so that everybody thinks he's a red hot king. So if you become king of Babylon, you say, oh, well, I want my palace. I think we'll have it over there. How do they do that? How do they do that? And we've found recently some incredible tablets which are about this big, which have on them the drawing of a courtyard with rims around it, drawn on the surface of the tablet, one piece like that. And they have holes in each end. And what happened was this, that in an architectural school, it must be like this, that they made lots and lots of tablets of this size with, say, a courtyard, the stables, the bit where the women lived, the bit where the men lived, where people changed for rugby, I don't know what it would be, all the different parts of the palace, each drawn on a clay tablet with holes in that you could peg together. So when the king came and said, well, come on, guys, you know, I'm paying you, let's see the blueprint. Well, they didn't have sheets of paper with blue lines on. They didn't have paper. So the only way they could do it was either draw it in the sand, for example, which would be stupid because 2 days later it would be destroyed, or by making up components. So if you knew that a royal building needed all these different sections, if you made these drawings on tablets with them all, they could be laid out on a table, fixed in position. And then the people who studied mathematics at school, who knew about weight bearing walls, they knew how thick bricks were, how many bricks you need in order to make an outer wall, they had to learn all these things. Then with the architects, the designer, they could lay out on the ground, marking it out with a peg and string, that kind of thing, in proportion to the miniature, lay it out on the ground. So the king would come out in the chariot and say, well, it's all right, looks a bit sparse. And you say, well, it's just the plan, Your Majesty. We have to build the thing. Now we've got the plan. So that's what they would do. And they would build it with knowledge of their own media. So when they made clay bricks, they would know about leaving gap for water to come out. They knew about drainage. They knew, I mean, they were proper intelligent people, like people are proper intelligent people today. And I can tell you that Babylonian engineers were a lot more reliable than half the people in the Yellow Pages in London. So they were trained in order to do a job properly. And we have all these things. They're just marvelous. You can follow a topic, trace it this way and that way, and sometimes there's a tablet in Philadelphia, and sometimes there's one in the Louvre, and sometimes there's one in Baghdad, and all these things, when they're put together, you suddenly get a whole picture. It's a marvelous thing.
Yeah Wow. Well, thank you for helping bring all of this alive and to help us see the connection of what is a 2,000 to 3,000 years ago, which is really very, like you say, similar to who we are today. And when I was reading your book, and also a bit of your doctoral dissertation, you talk about incantations, and you highlight how they frequently would include that it would be against any evil. So it just sort of, yes, like...
That's a funny thing, because they knew the names of the evil demons. So they sometimes say, whether you are a such and such demon, a Labatsu demon, a Hazu demon, a Lamashtu demon, all the names they had, 7 or 8 of them. And then they say, or any other evil, which means anyone I never thought of.
Right.
It's very fascinating, because that is what insurance companies do. When you take out insurance, they sometimes put a clause in that says about, for example, copyright or any medium which has not yet been invented. That's a special, malicious, nasty modern equivalent. So they had this idea of any evil as the last one in the list, but they knew what any evil looked like, because there are some tablets with drawings on of demons in the clay, so that the exorcist would make a model of the evil and either smash it or burn it or bury it or whatever it was. And there is a tablet with a drawing of any evil on it for as a role model. So I think that's hilarious, that an abstraction which could not really exist became something tangible. That's a very curious and interesting matter. The other thing is that one of the things which brings ancient magic and spells close to the modern world is the existence of abracadabra words, because everybody knows abracadabra or mumbo jumbo. They are still alive words in the language. Children know what abracadabra is. A magician will say it and out comes the rabbit from the hat if you're lucky. Well, it's actually a very ancient matter. And the principle of abracadabra is that you have magic words which are not in your own language. They might be in a very early part of your language, or they might be in some other language altogether. But the thing is, you don't actually know what they mean. And the words are prized after centuries of use. Sometimes they are transmitted from magician to magician with a bit of garbling in the principle, because if you hear something and you don't know what it means, you might not get the shape of the word perfectly. And if you have generations of exorcists saying, oh, this is a good word for this is a good spell for this, and telling you in your ear, you can imagine over that time that the words gradually become unrecognizable. So even if they did understand them at the outset, 100 or 200 years later, or maybe 1,000 years later, they've become garbled to the point that people recite them because they know they are powerful and magic and will banish the horrid demon. But if anybody said, okay, what does it mean? Tell me that. They would be unable to say. Of course, this has other implications in the modern world, because many people used to pray in Latin in church without having the faintest idea what the Latin meant until they stopped that. I mean, I suppose they thought that the Almighty, if there is an Almighty who was listening, if he was listening, took it at face value as well-meaning, even if they didn't understand it. But that is a very fascinating thing. And abracadabra and mumbo jumbo are part of that intellectual process.
Yeah. You've used the term exorcist a few times. Is the exorcist the same as the magician, or was their role primarily to cast out the ghosts were unwelcome and the evil spirits?
Yes, the magician could use the forces for lots of other things than driving out evil. So the exorcism or an exorcist is a specialist branch of the magician who might be called upon to bring rain if possible, or to make sure the battle is going to be successful, or all those sorts of things that the king would like him to do so that they felt good. All those sorts of things. They harness the same idea that forces can be bent to human purpose, but the exorcism is a specialist thing and, of course, more ringed around with danger. There is a tablet which shows that a young exorcist had to be in good physical to become an exorcist. You had to be in good physical shape and comely of appearance, not ugly, and things like that. So, and of course, pure in behavior. So they had a kind of self-defining process, making sure, because the battle of exorcism would, I suppose, have its dangers. Although they never tried to take the evil out of a person into themselves, they would never do that. The idea would be to drive the devil out to where it was supposed to go.
Mm-hmm. You've mentioned divination and one of those being astrology. I'd love to hear a little bit more about divination. And then also, if we could talk a bit about how they used magic or rituals to create what they wanted to have happen, you know, in the realm of intention.
Divination is one of their specialities. And they believed that if you were trained and expert and knew the literature, there were different sorts of things from which you could divine, you could tell what was going to happen. So some of these things were purely accidental. So things like if you're having your breakfast cereal and a frog falls from the rafters and lands in your cereal, this would be regarded as something with great ominous significance. And your professional scribe would have a tablet called If Frogs Appear Unexpectedly, and you'd be able to look up theoretically what it meant, and if necessary something will be done to dispel the potential evil of it. So there was a whole system. Of course, they didn't always do it. I suppose some people fished the frog out of the milk and chucked it into the yard and carried on eating their breakfast. But the point is, there's a myriad of chance events which could befall a human being, and they are all listed as far as they could think of it in one of these sorts of diagnostic texts, if these things happen by chance. And then there are related things like, for example, sometimes fetuses come to completion with some strange distortion about them or something wrong with them, and this is regarded as terribly, terribly ominous and dangerous. And all the possible things that could happen in that kind of abnormality are listed in two or three long tablets just to make sure. So, for example, if a sheep is born in the countryside with two heads, then somebody near to the king would need to know that this had happened. And probably they would send the thing in sort to be examined by the authorities. And then they would know that what a two-headed sheep might mean, and they would take steps about it. I mean, you could imagine a diviner would say, well, two-headed sheep, the kingdom is going to be divided between two rulers, and you know, we've got to do something fast. And so that's the thing. And there are other kinds of divination where you do things on purpose to get an answer. So one of those is you burn incense in a brazier, and the smoke, the way it curls up, the direction it goes in, is something that the expert knows what it means. Or you drop oil into water, those sorts of things, and the patterns are meaningful. But the most common thing, the biggest Mesopotamian thing about telling the future, is something rather strange, because they had a belief that the sun god was privy to what was going to happen. And I don't know whether he was privy one day at a time or one week at a time of what was going to happen, or whether he had the whole lot at his fingertips. But this was the understanding that the sun god knew. So they had a belief as follows, and nobody quite knows where it started, but it's the hallmark of the Mesopotamian diviner, this process, that you take a sheep from the, is usually for the king for most of its period. The later times it was a bit different, but traditionally it was for the king, from the king's herd of sheep. A fine sheep would be selected with no visible signs of disease or anything, and it would be turned on its back and opened up, and the liver taken out in one movement, and the liver will be held in the hands by the diviner, who would examine the main features of the liver, the small features of it, the shape of it, whether it had marks on it, spots on it, deformations on it, and all of the things that you might see on a liver, which were not on every liver, that's to say to some extent an abnormality or an idiosyncrasy, were regarded as a direct message from the sun god to the professional diviner who knew about these things. So if on the gallbladder there were three white pimples in a row, he would know what that meant when he looked it up, if he didn't remember, and there would be an omen that said if the gallbladder has one white pimple, it means this. If it has two white pimples, it means that, three, and so forth. So it was a highly technical, complex system where the secret behind the whole of the divination world, liver omens and all the others, was that as far as possible, the professional would have a reference work which covered every possibility, every possibility. So sometimes when they write down things that might happen, they are crazy. For example, you might have the sun appearing in the middle of a month, in the middle of the night, because if the sun appears on this, if sun appears and suddenly in the middle of the night you have the sun, that's not very likely. But they wanted to cover anything in case it happened, because where would they be if there was something very, very rare? And the king says, "Where are the diviners, man? I mean, look out the window. What the hell is this? And well, that's not supposed to happen." So they had to have everything there. That's a very important principle. And they had a second principle which ran side by side, which is this, that if something happened once upon a time and somebody noticed that shortly thereafter and apparently connected with it, then something else happened like that, it would be connected. So, for example, if somebody, let's imagine somebody, in fact, anything. Somebody had a fetus with four fingers instead of five fingers on one hand, right? That would be a very worrying thing. So say that this sort of thing does happen. So say there was a family once where a fetus was born, something like that. And the week after that, the house burned down. Because, you know, the expression, misfortunes never come singly. Well, if that is ever true, it's always true. So let's imagine that some ominous thing happened and then the house burned down. So as far as they were concerned, this was cause and effect. There'd be no one would ever dissuade them that it was nothing to do with one way or the other. So when you have that principle at loose in society, you have the capacity to accumulate experiences which provide a kind of core of divination matter. And then the expertise is you have to expand in every direction so you do cover everything. That's the thing. So you have what seems to me, so to speak, a fairly rational principle, although it may not stand up to scientific demonstration, that A caused B. Then the collection is that A always causes B, and that anything like A can cause something, anything like B. So it spreads out and spreads out. So if somebody reads one of these things, for example, in a book, they read half a page, I think these people must be insane. I mean, what the hell is this? You know, this is rubbish. But it's an unfair and misleading judgment, because if you know how it works, and the fact that the state was dependent upon divination in many ways, militarily, politically, they used divination as the main tool, then it wasn't nonsense. In its own terms, it had a kind of structure. And of course, there are many cases in the history of the world where omens dictated official policy. For example, in Tibet, when the Chinese came and they didn't know what to do with the Dalai Lama because they thought he would be at risk when the invaders arrived, they took omens and the omens said, go to India. So they did. So that's in recent memory, the same sort of principle. And the Assyrian king would never do anything serious without consulting the diviners. Of course, if he wanted to do something anyway, he might take no notice. But in principle, that was a thing that had to be done.
And that still happens today. There are presidents and leaders of countries who consult with diviners, astrologers, and so forth.
Yes, well, in many cases, it's probably better they do that than use their own judgment. But there you are.
Is there evidence as to how successful they were with these ancient magic rituals?
Well, with magic, you can't tell, because once it's done, it's done. But with drugs being prescribed for illnesses, you can. And one of the points is, I mentioned before that sometimes we can see that a plant goes through from Mesopotamia to Egypt to Greece and in medicine. So it holds on to its identity. But the other thing is, the compelling thing is, that we sometimes have recipes that in Mesopotamia demonstrably last for 2,000 years of time. So you have a manuscript and it's copied, and that's copied, and that's copied. And with the passage of time, care is taken to make sure that the recipe is complete. And no one is going to do that if nothing works. No one is going to do that. And when you have, which you do at root, you have the principle that local people know what drugs are good. If you have a burn, what to put on your skin. If you have a boil, if you have a stomach ache, this kind of mint plant will help. Or if you have a headache, whatever it would be. There's lots of really serious knowledge about how plants help people from the beginning of time. And they are part of that spectrum, before them and after them. So I should think quite a lot of things did work. And if they are compounded with, as I do imagine, the manner of the exorcist, which is either frightening or very kind, but something, not uninterested, but involved, will also lift the patient into conviction that they'll get better. They'll get better. So I think this probably is no more risky to have gone to one of Hammurabi's doctors for a normal ailment than it might be to go to a clinic today in London, especially if you can get an appointment, which is not so easy.
What is your favorite ancient magic ritual?
Well, I don't think about it like that. What I do like is when you have a spell where you can see that a word, especially a mumbo jumbo type of spell, you can see that the guy didn't understand it, but repeated it. But sometimes if you find an earlier version of the same line, you can detect the words that became garbled. This is very satisfactory to me that we can. So if this one of these guys came and said, hey, look, we got this magic stuff. I know, but do you know what that means? Because I do. That, I think, is a very nice, satisfactory principle.
Yeah. Do they say anything about their own intention behind it, their own consciousness as part of the magic?
Well, I think they regarded themselves as intermediary between patient and the gods. So they had a sort of responsible position. And they didn't believe in the gods as what you might call symbols or by convention, or we call them gods, but we don't really know what they are or anything like that. They believed in them. As I understand it from their inscriptions, in the traditional way that gods were not man, but they were there and they affected the world and they had good temper and bad temper and they had power. So they had the job between these rather intimidating and unpredictable persons and their patients, and in their hands they had life force and healing force and something like that. So I think there might have been people who, yes, there is one thing like that. In Babylon, in about the 4th century, there was a new kind of healing that took off. And it was to do with this, that you had to fumigate the patient for all sorts of different conditions. There's a whole big tablet of fumigation. So, and you had to fumigate the patient in order to restore their health or to deal with whatever was troubling them or to clear blockages or stuff like that. And the fumigation required the use of unguents or things like that, gums, which could be burned in order to produce the stuff like that, which were also not native to Iraq. They must have come from Arabia. And there was an ancient trade in unguents and things, gums from Arabia from the beginning of time, probably. And caravans must have gone trading stuff from Mesopotamia to minerals and things like that and brought them back. And one of the things they imported was these unguents. And the doctors on the equivalent of Harley Street in Babylon, there's probably a street where all the doctors lived, and they were probably fat and rich and corrupt, some of them. But anyway, there was a time when everybody was prescribing these unguents. And it's like aromatherapy in the modern world. It's aromatherapy. And I think the point was that these unguents were jolly expensive, because we have some alabaster bottles which must have had these things in with a bung in the top so they didn't evaporate, with the price on the side. So clearly this was a jolly good way to make money. So you say, I can see this is a serious condition here. I think we have to prescribe fumigation. Now, I know just the thing you'll need, but of course we'll have to order it. We'll have to get some in. It comes from Arabia. It might take a few weeks, and it's going to be a little costly, but I think you'll find it's worthwhile. So, of course, all the matrons, oh, yes, 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 my neighbour had it, worked a treat. So they would, and they had this fumigation, and they used it in the most remarkable ways. One of the most remarkable is that they use it for a woman who was unable to conceive a child. And what they would do, they had a special chair with a hole in it and a vessel underneath. And this woman would have to sit in the chair, and she was covered with a cloth. And the stuff would be lit underneath, and it was supposed to go up through her body, all through the passages in the woman's body, which they understood, and come out the mouth. So if they could smell it coming out of her mouth, they knew there was no blockage. I love that. I think that is marvellous. I have a feeling if one started a clinic on that principle, you become a multimillionaire in no time.
Oh, my gosh. What do I even say to that, Irving? That is hilarious.
It is quite hilarious. There is one other funny thing which I always get into trouble for, but I believe it to be the case. You know Herodotus, who is the father of history, who wrote in Greek, and he went to Babylon and he described what it was there. At least he says he went to Babylon, and see, people say he didn't go and he did go. I don't really care. But one of the things about him was he wrote a scandalous account of medicine in Babylonia. And he said that in Mesopotamia, when somebody's ill, they go and sit in the marketplace, and they wait there, and then somebody comes along who's had the same complaint, and they say, well, when I had this complaint, I did this, and look at me now. So that's their level of medicine. You wait for a victim who survived it. Well, when you look at the hundreds and hundreds of medical texts that we have over a 2,000-year period, which are orderly and, as I said, arranged in an encyclopedia, some of them very, very complicated things, I think this is what happened, that Herodotus, who was one of those journalists who was unbelievably irritating, always asking questions and writing them down with his confounded pencil and paper, probably went into the house of one of the most famous doctors in Babylon and said, tell me all about your medicine. You know, takes out his pencil, prepare. And the doctor says, well, we don't have any medicine here. We don't know anything about it. What happens when somebody's there? They just go to the market and they wait there. And if someone recognizes the sort of thing, they say, we know where I had it, or my dad had it. But then they tell him, and that's, and he wrote this all down like that, the system, that's how it worked. And marvelous. Rules it off, done that bit for his book. So he goes home, and eventually it's published. But the minute he leaves, The doctor gets up from his desk, pops next door to another doctor, said, "You'll never believe what happened. This idiot came in asking me a stupid question, and I told him about the marketplace, and he believed it. He believed it." So I think that's what happened.
We see that in a similar fashion in advertising today as well, with people who endorse certain products or services.
Well, I know anybody who believes in advertisement is a fool. Sounds to reason.
So did the woman conceive? Is there any evidence that method was effective?
They don't say. Unfortunately, they don't say. So we just have to use our imaginations. But there was quite a lot of things to help women in dystocia when they couldn't deliver a baby, to get pregnant. They could sometimes tell whether a woman was going to have twins, they said. And they do something to guarantee milk supply and all that. And that side of medicine was undoubtedly in the hands of women, not in men. Because if you were a smart person, you would never let another man anywhere near your wife, let alone to examine her for signs of pregnancy. So it must have been done by women, midwives and things like that. I'm going to pour some water.
Oh, yes. Please do. Good idea. Yes. And pour some water like they do for the ghosts, right?
Yes, but that's through a hole in the floor. And I don't think,
however
hospitable they are here.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yes, yes. They wouldn't allow it.
Whenever I read that in your book, I thought that was so sweet how they would pour water for them.
Well, I think they were quite sympathetic to ghosts on the principle that if they came back, it's because they were unhappy and they needed to be comforted. They weren't frightened as much as, I think, sympathetic.
They certainly took really good care, it seemed, of their ghosts.
Hmm.
Is there any correlation to some of what has been passed down through history of negative connotations with witchcraft that you see in ancient Mesopotamia? Like, do you see any influences of that?
People were frightened of witches, for certain. They weren't a fanciful figure of speech. They were... There's a very long composition to deal with witches, many spells, many descriptions, a long process. They believed in witches, but we can see how important it was, because you know that this King Hammurabi, who was king of Babylon in the 18th century BC, he was one of the most famous early kings of Mesopotamia, and he had a law code which was written on a pillar of diorite about 8 feet tall, which is in the Louvre in Paris. And the whole surface of this pillar is carved with laws. There are 392 or something laws regulating behavior. And if you do this, this is the result. And out of all these laws, the second one is about a witch. The second law. And if you accuse somebody of witchcraft, that they had a test in the river, you were dunked in the river, and if it turned out that your accusation was incorrect, you'd be put to death, and if it was correct, the witch would be put to death. So it's a pretty serious thing. And when they were codifying the laws, which were to do with inheritance and property and livestock and all manner of things in society to be sorted out, to be do as you would be done by, and to be fair to all parties, the second law is about witchcraft. So that means that at that time, that was the prevailing belief for evil that happens to people. And I think that later on, the devils and ghosts as a source of illness, which we were talking about before, it replaced witches as the primary cause, I believe.
Right, because it sounds like the exorcist was also the healer, and they assisted in benevolent ways, but the witches would assist in malevolent ways.
Yeah, but they were on their own. I mean, they did undoubtedly write evil spells. There are one or two spells which look like they are evil magic, which have come to light, but they're not many of them. But there were lots of poetic spells against witches and devices to drive them away and to punish them. People were very afraid of slander. There's a lot of spells in order to get rid of people whispering about you or talking about you, as if there was a common neurosis about it. It's very common. And that's the sort of thing that witches do when they get all that kind of thing.
Right, because there's there are different branches of witches these days. And
these days, I have no idea.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm talking about witches who've been dead for three millennia.
So right.
They're not such a source of panic. But I know that the very complex things today, it's quite a different matter.
Yeah, and there are groups of witches who do consider themselves to be healers and very in harmony with nature, so a different kind of witch, perhaps, than the definitely. Ancient one.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, definitely. But in the museums, you see sometimes things like a sheep's heart with nails in it and ribbons tied around it upside down in a glass jar. That sort of thing is an example of a sorcery where someone makes something which, while it exists, is a constant source of evil for the person, and it has to be found and destroyed, otherwise it lingers, like that sort of thing. And that's closer to the sort of activity that happened in Mesopotamia, I think.
Yeah, so it sounds like the ancient Mesopotamians believed that everything was predetermined or that was created by the gods. As you say, you don't know how far in advance the gods knew what their plans were, and that they were had those who assisted to mitigate the forces to help their lives.
Yes, I don't think they knew exactly what was going to happen. I think, this is a complex matter, because there is an expression about somebody that they died before their time, which is in a la shim tishu, somebody dies before their time. And this is an interesting thing, because it means that a person, so to speak, from their beginning, the plan was that they would live to 78, for example, something like that. But the plan is not cast in iron. And intrinsic to it is the possibility that something would happen and they would die earlier. So this is that idea that there's a kind of theoretical stretch and a realistic stretch probably applies to omens as well, and predicting the future in general. So that you, when you get an answer, it's like this, I think, that this will happen, all things being equal. But any number of things might come which interrupt it. I think that is the way in which the omen matter worked. It wasn't black and white. If this happens, this happens for certain. You could never have a system like that. So it must have been, as far as we know, this will happen, but everybody knows that, you know, there could be an earthquake, for example. You know, in insurance today, acts of God are allowed for, like a tsunami or a hit by lightning or something. They're nothing to do with man. Just as in modern insurance, these things are still legally valid. So that's the same sort of idea. They had the idea that not everything was cut and dried in that way.
Yeah.
It was a subtle system, I think.
Well, and there are many variables to life, which is why they had the if this happens or if that happens documents as well.
Yeah.
You mentioned a couple examples of these, but can you share a little bit more about how they used symbols with their magic?
Well, sometimes they would draw a magic circle on the floor with a trail of barley or something into which nothing could enter, or into which they would drive something. So sometimes you get rid of evil by, for example, putting it into a goat and then taking the goat out of the steppe and driving it out into the desert so that the evil would go away. There were lots of devices like that. So that's not usually. There's a rather remarkable thing where a man who has some kind of urinary infection has to urinate between the open jaws of a trout, a pike, which has to be held open by the exorcist, and then
it shuts and you throw it in the river and the evil goes away with that kind of thing. There's a lot of things like that. We don't do that in the museum, but there are a lot of things like that.
On that note, how much of this ancient Mesopotamian magic and rituals do you have a sense has survived today?
Well, if you want to say it survived, you have to demonstrate a survival. So one of the things you can demonstrate, there are probably lots, but at the moment I can think of only this, that when we had this discussion before about ghosts, when you want to bring a ghost up to answer questions, you have to do it by having a skull available of the person whose ghost you want. And the skull is on the table, and the sun god, who's in charge of all these things, brings up the ghost who goes into the skull and then answers your questions when you ask it. So this is what's prescribed in this necromantic ritual. It's a very frightening thing. I think it must have been utterly terrifying if, in fact, there was a noise out of this skull. I think people would die of terror. Anyway, the thing about that is that there are mentions in Greek and also in Greek sources and in Jewish sources in Aramaic, in the Talmud and rabbinic writings, of the whole idea of using a skull in this way. So to get it to tell you the future. So it's not just the idea of necromancy, but using a skull as the vehicle. And I think it's very likely that it's a survival of a Babylonian practice, which when people knew about it, it seemed to them the obvious way of doing it. And it lasted down into the Middle Ages. Although it is rather fascinating that one of the texts to do with this is written by a French rabbi in about the 14th century AD. And he says that they say that if you do this magic, the ghost comes in and speaks to you, and he says the question is, did the thing really speak or did he just imagine it? So by that time, the thinkers who are discussing these matters and looking at them askance have reached the stage, like a modern thinker, of asking, did they really hear the voice of this ghost or did they just imagine it? Which is what a modern person, with clinician, would say, is it not? If they about the same issue, that if you're hyped up and you expecting it and you've done all this stuff, and the slightest noise would be, you know, electrifying. But the praxis of divination, which is always a bit under the radar, using a skull, went from Babylonia into the Middle East and into Greek practice, and who knows what people do in London? I wouldn't know.
That's true. Right. Many of these things are kept behind closed doors, but more people are being brave to discuss them today.
You know, a long time ago, I had to give a lecture in the British Academy, and it was a very, very hot part of the summer. And so they closed all the curtains. So the light was rather poor. And I was up at the front of it with a desk talking with pictures behind me. And I brought with me a skull because I wanted to read out about this necromantic ritual and talk about it at some length. So on the desk in front of me, I put this skull, and I gave the lecture. And it was a friend of mine called Dominique Collon, who used to work in my department, a wonderful person. She came late to this lecture with a little old lady she knew. They were very late and they sat right at the back. And because the drapes were pulled, the room wasn't very light. And so this old lady was looking and looking and looking. And Dominique told me afterwards that when it was over, she said, well, it was very interesting, but who was that little bloke sitting next to him? And she thought that this cranium was a person. So I'm rather proud of that skull. It's a handy thing to have.
Have you adopted any of these ancient magic rituals in your life?
No, not yet.
Not yet.
Not yet. I have a few up my sleeve, but we'll have to wait and see.
And when did you know that you are a wizard?
Well, I'm not a wizard. I mean, I know all these things. I've read all these things. But You'd have to be a practitioner to do that, to qualify as a wizard.
Yeah, that was a question for my husband.
Oh, well, I better have a word with your husband later, perhaps.
Do you have anything else you want to share today about ancient magic rituals?
Well, yes. I found in the museum a cluster of about 30 unknown tablets from about the 3rd century BC. They're near the end of the cuneiform world, right at the end of the cuneiform world. And they are to do with dreams. And the Mesopotamians collected dreams because they used them to predict the future. And they knew about evil dreams and how to get rid of them. And sometimes the kings had dreams. So there's a whole slew of stuff about dreams. But these are something different, because the point there was this, that there were specialist practitioners whom you could employ, so that you would go on the roof and lie down on a kind of bed. They'd burn incense, and at the right time, the diviner or the dream operator would do a lot of magic, so that when you were asleep, you would get a dream. And the dream would come up from below, because they lived in the netherworld, and the dream god would either bring a dream and give it to you, or the winds would bring a dream, and you would experience the dream while you were asleep. And the idea was that you had a burning question, an important question, which would be answered by this dream. So there are about 15 different documents with similar but not identical things. They're all very interesting. And it's a new side of the whole matter, how you have a dream if you want to find out what's going to happen. Now, the annoying thing is that none of the questions are there.
Mm.
None of the questions are there. And also, we don't know how it worked. So, for example, let's say your question might be this: should I get married again? And then if you're going to get an answer, will my wife outlive me? Will she be faithful to me? Will I have a son, for example? Those four questions. So if you're going to do this, it wouldn't just be one question. You probably have four questions. So what do? Do you lie down concentrating on these questions until you fall asleep, so that the dream god picks up on it, like by radar, and knows what the questions are? This is one possibility. Although if you go to sleep clenched up trying to think of something, you won't go to sleep anyway. But leaving that aside, that's one thing, that you have it so much in your mind that the dream god can read it. He doesn't say this. I don't know. This is one explanation. Another explanation is that you tell the dream specialist, and the dream specialist reads out the questions. It says here, my client wants to know, should he get married again? If so, is the woman going to be faithful to him? Will she have a son? And also, will she outlive him? Which are reasonable questions. So maybe he reads it out loud as the guy is going to sleep, so that the forces hear all this and they look it up in the book, or they do that, and then they somehow give an answer. So how do they do it? Is it written on the wall? Does the dream come? I mean, I had an idea. You know, in Hamlet, when the actors come and they do a dumb show in front of, to show how Polonius was murdered in the orchard. You remember that thing in Hamlet? Very important thing. Well, I thought maybe what happens is, when you have a dream, there's some bloke and some wife, and they have a terrible fight. And so you think, no, I'm not going to get married again. I don't want any of that stuff. It would be a kind of lesson or something. How does it work? We have no idea. We have no idea. But there's a very interesting remark, which is sometimes written on tablets like this. And it says the following: the seer will see and the hearer will hear.
Beautiful.
Now, it might be beautiful, but I don't think that means anything. What I think it means is that people who can see will see, and people who can hear will hear. And that this is a special clause put in by the specialists who do this, so that if it doesn't work, nobody minds. That's my idea.
There's certainly a couple ways to look at that.
Exactly.
Dr. Irving Finkel, it's been a joy and delight being with you again today. Thank you so much for being with me.
It's a pleasure. Anytime. All right. Bye-bye then.
And for those of you listening or watching, thank you for being with us. You are the reason that we are here.
I imagine that by now, many of you already realize that, in conjunction with White Crow Books, we've just launched the new Thinking Aloud Dialogues book imprint, and our first title is There Life After Death?